If something has gone wrong in the world, the chances are someone is trying to fix it. And here on People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service, we find the people who are trying to do just that. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People fixing the world.
Welcome to People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service. I'm Jamie Ryan. This is the programme that looks for the solutions to the problems that face the planet. But today we aren't looking so much at the people fixing the world, but the mollusks fixing the world. I'm on a pier in Arcachon, about an hour away from Bordeaux in France. The oceans that I'm standing by are facing some big problems, and I don't just mean plastic pollution, overfishing, chemical pollution, shore destabilisation. These are things that affect the animals living in the sea, but also us. But there's one type of creature that might be able to help clean the ocean, the bivalve. Bivalves are things like clams, oysters, cockles, mussels and scallops. They live on pretty much every shoreline in the world, but their numbers have fallen due to overfishing and pollution. And in some places, they've been wiped out entirely. Around the world, there are people trying to put oysters back into the ocean to put their sea cleaning powers to use. And I'm here in France to meet one of those people. Now, his lab is just off the seafront. Bonjour, Jean-Charles. It's Jamie. Jamie Ryan. Hello.
Jamie, where are you?
I think I'm outside the building.
You are in front of the door?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I'm coming.
Thank you very much. I'll see you in a second. Jean-Charles Massibou is a marine biologist studying oysters at the university in Arcachon.
When you enter in this lab, you have to speak slowly. Everything must be slow and quiet, and the oysters are more happy, in fact.
Inside his lab, he has fish tanks filled with oysters, each about the size of a hand. They're circular and rough, and they look a bit like rocks.
I find the aquatic environment fascinating. I fall in love with water a long time ago. And I think that for me, bivalves and oysters are more fascinating than others.
Oysters are shellfish. They don't move around, but they do open and close along a seam in their shell, revealing the white blob of their body. It looks a bit like a mushroom. They grow in large clusters, becoming oyster reefs. Known as a delicacy to eat, some produce pearls used in jewellery. But what interests Jean-Charles is how they feel.
If you just look at them, you understand nothing. If you play with a cat or with a dog, you know when he is happy, when he's not happy. Trying to do that with an oyster or a mussel, it's impossible to understand. But if you imagine special tools to penetrate them, to have a feedback from them, then it's fantastic because you open the window.
The window it opens is into the watery world in which this creature lives.
Everybody knows the story of the canary in the mine, and we can use oysters as canary in the mine, in fact, oysters in the sea.
Oysters constantly suck water in and out through their gills. As they do so, they remove bits of living matter from the water to eat. So in a way, they're constantly tasting the water. And like us humans, if there's something nasty in the air, they sort of cough or hyperventilate if there's something nasty in the water. Jean-Charles is trying to check when they do that.
The trick is that you must learn how to read on their lips. In fact, more exactly, how to read on their shells' movements. We develop new systems able to record 24 hours a day all their shell movements. And like that, we know when they sleep, when they are awake. We study their biological rhythms to understand if they are normal or abnormal. It can be quite clear on our recordings. And like that, for example, we know that they are disturbed. They don't behave normally.
His system involves attaching matchstick-sized electromagnets to the oyster's shell so he can check when they open and close. As the oyster moves, the matchsticks touch and data is registered. The more they move, the dirtier the water.
This piece of electronics records all their movements. Then there is an umbilical cable going up to the surface. Or this piece of electronic is equipped with what you have in your smartphone, and with an antenna and a SIM card.
So the wires from the oysters go up to a buoy bobbing on the ocean's surface, which has a solar panel and a mobile phone on. Once a day...
Every night, at midnight, Greenwich time.
Jean-Charles gets a text with the data on. His biomonitoring oysters have been developed to check the water quality around oil rigs. He's hoping to catch pollutants in the water before they become a bigger problem for the habitat.
The system will tell you, oh wow, I'm not happy. There is something disgusting in this water. I'm dying or I am disturbed. I can't sleep, I can't rest, I can't spawn. I don't know what is it. But then you have to know as a scientist, and then you can come and sample water and analyze. Try to analyze.
Hundreds of wired-up water monitoring mollusks sit on seabeds near oil rigs across the globe. East of Australia, French Polynesia, and there's a whole host of them near France and Spain. The project is mostly funded by the French National Centre for Scientific Research, but some of the funding comes from the oil company Total. Jean-Charles says his oysters are far from a green stamp of approval for the company.
And for me, I'm a civil servant. I don't want to be a stamp or something like that to say, okay, I guarantee that the quality is good because we are here. I really want to help them to do better.
And I guess the worry is that this could just look like very good public relations for them. Mm-hmm.
It's very hard, in fact. And it shows that to be able to show to the public that oysters are looking after them, are checking every day that they are working properly and nicely.
Because the oysters are highly sensitive, too much pollution will just kill them. So they're useful for sensing smaller leaks. For example, where an engineer has made a tweak to the system, but doesn't realise that a small amount of oil is going to the sea as a result. The tiny leak makes the oysters change their behaviour, and they can look in the maintenance logs to figure out the cause. So far, they've been able to detect a number of these smaller leaks. Nothing huge, but problems that could have caused big issues if left unattended. Oysters aren't just useful to detect chemicals in the water. They can also help clean the water by eating the nasty bits floating around. Almost like a...
filtration pump.
Filtration pump.
There we go.
Dr. Joanne Preston is a marine biologist from the University of Portsmouth. She's running a project on the Solent, a busy stretch of water off the south coast of England, bustling with cruise liners, container ships and recreational boats. But it used to be busy for another reason. It used to be brimming with oysters. In 1978, 15 million of them were fished from the Solent, but that number has fallen dramatically.
When we did 300 grabs across three harbours, we found three oysters.
Right.
Okay. So they're not anywhere near that 15 million. So put that in perspective, in 1864, it's thought, estimated that 700 million oysters were consumed in London alone in that year. So actually, the ecosystem would look very different to provide those number of oysters to eat.
These waters are now home to something else, algae.
You can see the water around here, it's really green. Mm-hmm. It's because of those microscopic algae.
Have we got any algae here?
So this is some what's called macroalgae, because it's large.
Oh, it looks like green hair or green nylon. Hair. Oh, it feels awful.
Algae, the green plant-like stuff in the water, grows using photosynthesis. But that growth is limited by the amount of nitrogen in the water.
So if you get the same bit of sea with the same amount of sunshine and you put a whole lot of nitrogen into one, you'll get far more algae.
Which is exactly what happens when nitrogen-rich fertiliser washes down from the farmland into the sea. It causes algae to grow at unnatural levels, blocking sunlight from other plants, and then...
When the algae dies and they decompose, that uses up all the oxygen in the water, and so that's not as good for fish.
Everything dies because of...
Yeah, of these algal blooms. And you can see it around the world. You have these big algal blooms, and then you just get massive fish mortality.
But our hero, the oyster... can help.
So basically they will just filter the water. So they'll basically pump the water across their gills And what they do is they eat the sort of food floating in the water column. So bits of algae and other little organic matter, and they'll just filter that and then sort of they'll transfer it into their stomach, and that's where they get their food. Basically, they just churn through.
So they eat the food of the algae and the algae.
Yeah.
They eat the algae and they absorb nitrogen from the water. So it's bad news for the ocean ecosystem that oyster numbers have fallen significantly around the world. But Dr. Preston leads one of those teams trying to turn the tide by reintroducing them. They're currently in the planning stage, testing how many oysters they'd need to put back into the water so they can breed and thrive. We went out on a boat to see how some of those reintroduction sites are doing. They check that by using a machine. It looks a bit like a beak on a string that brings up samples of the environment beneath the waves.
For each grab, we're taking some of just a sample of the seabed to see if what we've done has impacted or changed the sediment in any way, the seabed, and to really get an idea where the most suitable place is to put more oysters down. And then we're going to sieve this mud over this box and this mesh to get out all the organisms in it and see what biodiversity is living in the mud.
On each grab from the bottom, they test how the reintroduced oysters are doing.
A native oyster shell, there's only one half of it, so that's an old one, that one will be put down.
It's dead.
That one's dead, it's just half an oyster, another half an oyster. So there's some more sea squirts.
Oh,
sorry.
Those squeezy ones.
It has to be done. There's some sponges, lots of crocodula.
Is that a squirt?
No, it's a hermit crab.
Oh.
I thought it was a whelk, but it's a hermit crab. There we go.
The oysters they've introduced haven't taken hold at this site, either because of the tide or lack of breeding partners or something else. One of the big difficulties is the habitat they've been left with. The favourite place for baby oysters to settle is on the shell of other oysters. They grow on top of each other, but there aren't any left to settle on. So it's back to the drawing board, or rather, back to the oyster nursery.
Is that heavy?
Yep.
Very good.
So I just want to catch the other cage.
Yeah. Under a pier, the team have two metal cages where they grow their baby oysters. They plan to reseed millions of oysters over the next 5 years, once they know where to put them.
Why is it squirting water out?
Yeah. That's not the oyster.
It's a shrimp. Look at it.
This is what's called a skeleton shrimp.
Why is it spitting?
Look
at him flipping out.
Yeah. And basically just they've adapted their sort of usual swimming legs just to hold onto bits of algae.
They haven't seen big impacts on the amount of algae in the water yet, but in the cages you can see other benefits.
What's this stuff growing on the cage?
There's a whole world on this cage. These are hydroids. These are actual animals, not plants. They look like little plants.
Is this stuff good to have or is it bad to have?
This is good. This is biodiversity. This is good.
Yeah.
What the oysters do, they provide basically a framework for other things to live on. As you can see, there's probably around 40 or 50 species on this oyster if you drill down into it.
Yeah,
the sponges. There's probably a load of shrimps. There's the ones we've just seen there. We've got these sort of fan-like bryozoans and some worms. And there's another sponge there. There's what's called a... looks a bit like a sea spider. The oyster itself provides this sort of, they call it a biogenic ecosystem. So the organisms themselves create structures that other things live on.
And with a lack of oysters, there's lack of biodiversity.
Yeah. And what all these things that are sort of living on it, this is great food for small juvenile fish. And so actually the biodiversity that lives on the oyster provides food for small juvenile fish. And as they create these sort of reef-like structures or grow together, juvenile fish can sort of feed and hide from predators and various other things.
Reintroducing oysters in the Solent is just getting up and running. But there's a project over on the other side of the Atlantic where it's well underway.
Yeah, my name is Pete Malinowski, and my title is Executive Director of Billion Oyster Project. So we essentially train students and volunteers to grow and restore oysters throughout New York Harbor. And so it's fundamentally an effort to get New Yorkers engaged in restoring the natural environment where they live and use that effort as a way to change public opinion and public behavior as it relates to the resource.
Students from local schools are helping to install massive oyster reefs in New York Harbor. They're learning about tides, geography, and water pollution while they're doing it. But it has a more practical purpose too.
You can think of oyster reefs just like coral reefs or this sort of trees in a forest, right? They provide the three-dimensional structure of the ecosystem. And New York Harbor used to be totally full of oyster reefs. And we harvested them all for food and shipped them all over the world and, you know, removed that habitat from the harbor. So one way to think about New York Harbor now is a forest without trees. All of that habitat has been removed.
The oyster reefs used to reach heights of up to 6 meters from the seabed.
Historically, when, you know, New York Harbor was full of these large reefs, they actually physically break the waves. And so New York Harbor back then was much calmer. And even during extreme weather events, the wave impact on shore was much less than it is now. New York City is one of the most vulnerable cities in the world to climate change and rising water levels because so much of the city is so close to sea level. Oyster reefs on their own are not going to keep the water out of New York City.
Most of the New York shoreline is made from hard stuff, steel, concrete, or rubble.
Oyster reefs can play a role in places where there's a softer shoreline. We have a project going on in Staten Island called the Living Breakwaters Project, you know, where oyster reefs are part of a breakwater system that'll protect the shore from waves.
Oyster reefs act as a biological barrier to reduce erosion, and they don't need any upkeep once established. Currently, 10 years in, and reintroduction is going slowly. They're a way off from the billion oysters.
How many have you installed up till now?
Just under 30 million oysters, so we have about 971 million to go before we get to our billion.
That's some very quick maths.
I've said that a few times.
Are you on track to finish, do you think?
Well, at our current rate, it will take us about 150 years to get to a billion. But we're planning on, and we have been, increasing our capacity to restore our oysters every year.
Pete says that if their job was to constantly go out installing reefs, they'd be much more efficient. But because so much of their work involves teaching children, it slows it down. And just like in the Solent, the oysters here are struggling to settle due to a lack of habitat. They find muddy bottoms and not hard oysters. But the team are finding a way around that.
So we actually operate a shell collection program at about 80 restaurants in Brooklyn and Manhattan and collect about 8,000 pounds of shell per week from the, you know, removing it from the waste stream and bringing it out to Governor's Island. And we use that as our reef substrate.
There's also a lot of bureaucracy involved in the process. Regulations and permissions are needed before they can put any oysters down, mainly because the oysters could cause harm if they're eaten because of the water they live in.
Our restored oysters are seen as a public health risk. So because New Yorkers cannot be trusted to live near a natural resource that could get them sick, that fact, that fear, is the most restrictive single thing on our ability to restore oysters.
I take it you would not want to eat the oysters that which you are installing.
No, the oysters are not for eating. They have a much more important job to do. And until we stop pouring untreated household wastewater into the harbor, we won't be able to eat the oysters.
For our next stop on this oyster world tour, somewhere the oysters definitely are for eating.
We eat oysters for hunger, and you, in the West, you eat it for pleasure. It's a delicacy.
This is Fatou Jana Maboub, the director and founder of the Tri Oyster Women's Association. She's based in the Gambia, where groups of women collect oysters from the mangroves and sell them on the roadside.
I stopped by to buy oysters as a customer and started chatting with them. I realized that they were not organized at all. Nobody paid attention to them, the government or anybody. So that's how we said, okay, well, let's start to do something with ourselves.
Fatou soon discovered that the women were living in extreme poverty because the price of oysters was so low, but they were still risking their lives to collect them.
We lost 3 or 4 of them. They drowned because of lack of protective working gear.
She persuaded 15 villages along the coast with over 500 female oyster harvesters to form a cooperative. They got hold of proper protective gear, trained them on how to collect the oysters without damaging the mangrove, and told the consumers they'd have to pay more for their shellfish.
The women have now, they earn their living in selling oysters than before. They're able to pay school fees for their children, whom before, yeah, I mean, it was not possible because of the little money they earn. We have been given exclusive use rights to manage the Tanbi National Park, which is one of a kind. I mean, really, you don't see that in sub-Saharan Africa. For the whole shellfish to be entrusted to women, that has not happened. So we are very proud of that. And the women are now able to go to the bank, like me and you, to go and save their money. And through the trainings, they're able to also understand their health issues. We give them health training, basic things like when they're suffering from menopausal problems, they don't understand. And they wouldn't go to the doctor like me and you will do. They will go to the local doctors. And all this is no more. They are now empowered. They can now make their own decision, and they are very proud of themselves.
Coming to the end of this journey, looking at what the oyster can do to help us out, my boss and I realised that I haven't ever eaten one. I have been warned that I may not like them. So, I'm in Borough Market, outside the shop Richard Hayard's Oysters, because for 8 generations, the Hayards have been growing oysters in the UK. I'm here to meet Sam, who's going to show me what to do.
Back in like the Victorian times, there'd be an oyster cellar on every street corner. They were in every person's food. And people would actually use them in their cooking to sort of thicken out their meals. Nowadays, they are considered quite high class.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not entirely sure. I think maybe marketing. And then also, yeah, when the numbers did start to dwindle a little bit, maybe it was because they were few and far between. But certainly that's not the case these days, so I don't know why they're still.
What kind of nutritional benefits do they bring?
So, I mean, an oyster is packed full of vitamins and minerals. It's got vitamin B12, vitamin D, zinc, magnesium.
They're low calorie, low fat, but not only that. Sustainably sourced oysters appear to be one of the few forms of meat that is actually good for the environment.
Farming the oysters doesn't really have a negative impact on the environment around. In fact, higher numbers of oysters is better for the environment around. They take pollutants out of the water and excrete nutrients back into the water.
So I've never, ever had an oyster, despite spending quite a long time researching them. I like shellfish, but I'm apprehensive.
It's understandable. I mean, they don't necessarily look the most appetising. I can understand that. Some people might not think that. But I would say, honestly, I can't countless people have their first oyster, and I would say 98 to 99% of them have all enjoyed them.
I think there's only really one way left, one thing left to do. Bottoms up. It's really nice. I've been so long worried about it. That's the end of People Fixing the World this week. If you've seen a project we should look at, or just want to get in touch, find us on Facebook or drop us an email. It's peoplefixingtheworld@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
This is the Global News Podcast
from the BBC World Service.
The Global News Podcast is a snapshot that we take twice a day on weekdays, once a day at the weekend, explain to people what's happened in the last 12 hours, last 24 hours that really matters, why it matters, and why we should care.
President Trump has announced new tariffs on China.
All schools in Sudan have been closed.
Pakistan called India's announcement illegal.
It's very, very easy to be paying attention to only the stories that you're already interested in. And it's quite important to go outside your bubble, outside your national borders, and to find out what is going on elsewhere in the world and how the rest of the world looks at you.
Protesters are all charging in a certain direction like they are right now. And another time, the riot police will attack.
The Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service.
Will electric ear tickling really make you live longer?
Seriously, if you're not listening to us, what are you listening to?